Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is July the 26th. We are in Melachim Beis, Perek Zion, Chapter 7. And last time, we're in the beginning of the Perek, we're up to Pasuk Hey, verse 5. That we have the four Mitzoraim, we have Gehazi, who has Tzaras with his three sons. They are outside the city of Shomron. The city of Shomron is under heavy siege and is starving to death. And they make the calculation. If they remain where they are, they're going to die. If they go and allow themselves to be captured by the camp of Aram, then they might live. And we discussed last time that they were risking forfeiting their lives more quickly than they would have died otherwise. But there's the possible gain of being able to live and not die at all. And they made the correct, they arrived at the correct conclusion that it is appropriate to attempt to live and not die at all. So that's what we're up to in Pasuk Hey. Vayakumu v'aneshef, they got up in the twilight, right? Thank you. Lavo el machane Aram, to come to the camp of Aram. Vayavo ad kitzei machane Aram, they came to the edge of the camp of Aram. Vine en shamish, there's nobody there. There's this massive army, a huge, huge army that Aram has, and no one is there. So now the Navi gives us the background. Why was nobody there? V'Hashem ishmias machane Aram, Hashem had made the camp of Aram hear kol rechev v'kol sus, the sound of chariots, the sound of horses, kol chayol gadol, the sound of a great army. V'yomru ish al achiv, and each man said to his brother, hinei sachar aleinu melech Yisrael asmalche hachitim v'asmalche mitzrayim lavo aleinu. The king of Yisrael has hired the kings of the Chittim and the kings of Mitzrayim to come after us. He's hired armies, mercenaries, to come help him in the war against us. Vayakumu, vayanusu vaneshef, they got up and they ran away in the twilight. Vayazvu es ahalehem, and they left behind their tents. Ves susayim, and their horses. Ves chamoreim, and their donkeys. Hamachane kasher hi, the camp as it was. Vayanusu el nafsham, they ran for their lives. The soldiers of Aram became terrified. They dropped everything, literally dropped everything, and ran. So they left a completely empty camp. Now this camp was fortified and was full of supplies for thousands and thousands and thousands of soldiers for a a lengthy siege. So it's for many days that they're supplied, and they dropped everything and ran. So now they have an immense amount of supplies here in this camp. So these Mitzoraim came to the edge of the camp. They came to the first tent. They drank. They were hungry, which is why they came there in the first place. So they ate and they drank. Not only that, but now there's wealth available to them. They carried from there silver and gold and clothing, vayelchu vayatminu, and they went and they hid the silver, the gold, and the clothing. Vayashuvu, they came back. Vayavo el acher, they came to another tent. Vayisum isham, they carried off booty from there as well. Vayelchu vayatminu, and they went and they buried it. Remember that the city of Shomron is under siege. Nobody knows that the soldiers of Aram are gone, so the city is under siege. They're starving to death. The four Mitzoraim, they eat and they drink. They carry off booty and they bury it. They come back. They search another tent, carry off booty, and bury that. Now they finally come to their senses. Vayomru ish al re'ehu. So each man said to his friend, this is not right what we're doing. Today is a day of announcing news. V'anachnu machshim, and we are keeping it quiet. We're keeping it to ourselves. V'chikinu ador haboker, we'll wait until the morning, the light of the morning. U'mitza'anu avon, then sin will find us. Because in the morning it will be clear that we knew this information all night and we didn't say anything. V'atol l'chu v'navoa, now let us go and come, v'nagida beis hamelech, and tell the king. So what is motivating the four mitzorayim to inform the people of Shomron that there is food available? Yeah?
Well, two things. One is duty. They know they're supposed to do it. And two, it's going to, every minute that they delay, they kind of come to their senses after they've eaten something. Every minute that they delay is looking worse and worse for them. Why didn't they share the information with the rest of the community?
Okay, so every minute is looking worse and worse. So they need to share the information.
Right.
It does not say that the reason why they need to tell the people of Shomron is because people are starving to death. Because, as we learned last week, because people are eating their own dead children. That is not why they need to go tell the people of Shomron. The reason is because we look pretty bad if we don't go tell them. Just to give you a sense of the selfishness here, that this is not an act of altruism that we need to help our fellow Jews who are in a terrible place and they're literally starving to death, and therefore we need to go tell them.
Did the people in Shomron know they were there? They were outside. They're Mitzorim and they were outside.
Yeah. They didn't know where they were.
Yeah, but I mean, they knew where they were.
And they may have been dead. They may have been captured. Yeah. You know, there's no way to know. But they are not being motivated by a need to help their fellow Jews. They're being motivated by a need to protect themselves. And that's what's driving them over here. Yeah.
When they say sin, it will be sinful. Are they worried about a sin against Hashem?
No.
Or a sin against people?
Yeah, they're worried about looking, right. Looking
so the word
bad.
Sin can be used in that context.
Yeah, yeah. Lacking, they appear to be lacking, they appear to be shirking their responsibility.
Man.
Yeah.
Did we talk about why they were lepers in the first place?
Yeah, that was discussed already.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's fine. It's fine, but that we discussed. We're going to get back to it a little bit. You'll hear. Pasuk Yud, verse 10. Vayavo, they came, Vayikru el Shoer Ha'ir, they called out to the gatekeeper of the city. Gatekeepers of the city. Vayaginu lohem lemer, they told them, saying, Banu el machane Aram, we came to the camp of Aram, v'ine ein sham ish v'kol adam, there was nobody there and no sound of any man. Kim asus asur, the horses were tied up, v'achamor asur, and the donkeys were tied up, v'olim kasher hema, and the tents were as they were. So what do you do with this information? So the gatekeepers called out and they told the house of the king, the inner chamber, which means they let the king know. The information was brought to the king. The king got up at night, in the middle of the night. And he said to his servants, I'll tell you now what Aram is doing to us. Meaning, we can't trust this new information. Yadu kireivim anachnu, they knew that we were starving. Vayetsu mina machane lehechavei basadeh et lemor, and they went out of the camp to hide in the field, saying, kietsu mino ir, when they come out of the city, v'nispesem chayim, we'll capture them alive. V'lo ir navo, and then we'll come to the city, it'll be easy for us to capture the city. This is a ploy, this is a trick. That the people of Aram, the soldiers, it's a clever trick in order to capture us, because we're going to come out of the city unaware that they really are right nearby, and then they'll pounce on us and capture us. Now, neither the gatekeepers nor the king question the four Mitzorayim. One could question them, that perhaps they're making up a story. Maybe the camp of Aram got these four Mitzorayim to come and announce this false story. Really, the camp of Aram is fully staffed, and they haven't run away at all. and they're just making up this. They're bribing these four Mitzarayim, or threatening them with their lives, that they come and report this fantastic story.
Also, why wouldn't the Mitzarayim, when they were there, not just grab a few horses with them and grab whatever food just in case they do come back and come like that into the city? No, I mean, if you've got all this fortune, you don't know what's going to happen in an hour. Maybe they really will come back. Why not just grab what you can?
Yeah, so bring it. It seems they were there long enough. They ate, they buried treasure, they came back, got more buried treasure.
Take a bunch of horses, they, donkeys, whatever.
Proof. Yeah, she's saying they should have brought proof.
Not even proof, even just...
Okay, that's proof. So I'm saying, well, hold on, let's take a step back. So what you're pointing out is that...
Load food on the donkeys and then schlep it over there.
So what's that? So you're pointing out, you see the four Mitzrayim were not concerned that he was coming back. No. They realized they're gone. There was no fear that they're coming back. That's clear. So, but the question is, how come the king trusted the four Mitzrayim? He trusts them. He doesn't trust the camp of Aram. He's afraid the camp of Aram have deceived the four Mitzrayim into getting them to come out of the city. But he's not afraid that the four Mitzrayim are making up a story. That he's not afraid of. So why would the king not be afraid that the four Mitzrayim have made up a story? Right? It seems like he implicitly trusts them. I would point out to you, I don't know if the king's trust was well placed, because the four Mitzrayim do not seem to care about the city, they care about their own necks. But the king seems to assume that they would never sell us out. The four Mitzrayim would never sell out the city of Shomron. To even under the pain of death, they would not make up a story like this in order to get us all captured. That's not what I'm afraid of. What I'm afraid is that they're coming honestly. They honestly believe that the camp that the soldiers have run away, but in truth, they're really hiding. So just to show you, I'm just pointing out to you that the four Mitzrayim themselves, we saw clearly, do not care for the livelihood of their fellow Jews. But the king assumes that they do care for the livelihood of their fellow Jews to the extent that they would never sell them out, even at the pain of death. It's an interesting thing that's going on over here. Now remember, the four Mitzrayim are Gehazi, who was before he went bad, he was a great person. But the king seems to trust him. Now we're going to have later on that the king Gehazi is an interesting figure. We've already mentioned several times. We're going to talk about him more, but we'll see more about him later. We're not done with him. Even at the end of this story, we'll not be done with Gehazi. So the king is afraid that it's all a trick. So Pasuk Yud Gimel, verse 13. Vayan echad me'avadav vayomer. So one of the servants of the king answered and said, V'ikhuna chamisha minas husim hanisharim. Please take now from the five horses that are left, ashenish aruva, that have remained here in Shomron, hinam kechol hamon Yisrael ashenish aruva. They are like all the multitudes of the Jews that are here, that are left in Shomron, which means, well, let's read a little further. Hinam kechol amon Yisrael asher tamu. They are like all the other multitudes of Jews that have ended, that have died. V'nishtacha v'nireh, let us send them and let us see. Meaning, let's send the five horses. Maybe you'll say, but then we'll lose the five horses. So the servant says, they're like the rest of the people. If you don't send the five horses, the horses are going to die just like everybody else is going to die of starvation. We're all dying of starvation. So there's no point in trying to save the horses for an emergency situation. There's nothing left. If we don't take advantage now, we're finished anyway. So now's the time to use our last horses. Don't tell me that we can't send the horses, because what happens if? There's no more ifs. We're our backs are against the wall. Pasuk Yudal, verse 14. Vayikhu shnei rechev susim. They took two chariots of horses. Vayishlach hamelech acharei machane Aram lemor. And the king sent after the camp of Aram, saying, L'chu uru, go and see. They went after them all the way till the Yarden. The whole road was filled with discarded clothing and utensils that Aram threw in their haste. As they're running away, they're trying to run away, and these things are burdening them, the loads are burning them, so they're throwing everything off in order to be able to go faster. And the messengers came back. They told the king. So now they realized that this was not a trick, that in fact it really was true. The soldiers of Aram were gone. The nation went out. And they bespoiled the camp of Aram. So there was a plenty of food and clothing, etc. Vayihisa solas b'shekel, and then a saw of flour, of a fine wheat flour, was now the price of a shekel. V'sasayim saorim b'shekel, and two saw of barley flour was now a shekel. Kidvar Hashem, like the word of Hashem. This is in contrast to what we said before in Perek Vav in chapter 6, that the head of a donkey was worth 80 silver coins, and a quarter of a kav of animal dung was worth 5 silver coins. And now the price of food has dropped to its normal, very low cost. So exactly as Hashem said from Elisha, that not only is the siege ended, but there's now plenty of food for everybody. V'amelech hifkid es ha-shalish asher nishan al yodo. And the king had appointed the advisor that he had been leaning on his arm, Al-Ashar, at the gate. Meaning he had appointed that advisor at the gate so that people will go out in an orderly fashion. There shouldn't be a stampede. So he had appointed that advisor at the gate. Vayirmisuhu ha'am bashar vayamos. The nation trampled him at the gate and he was killed. Kashadibar Isha Elohim, just as the man of Hashem, as Elisha had said, Ashadibar that he had said, Beredes HaMelech Elav, and the king had come down to him. Vayihi Kedaber Isha Elohim, and it was exactly as the man of Hashem had said, El HaMelech, to the king Lamar, saying, Sasayim Sorim B'Shekel, Usa Solis B'Shekel, Yehaka Ismachar B'Shah Shomron, that by tomorrow, the two saw of barley flour will be worth a shekel, and one saw of fine wheat flour will be worth a shekel in the gates of Shomron. Vayana Shalish, and if you'll recall, the advisor had answered, as Isha Elohim, the man of Hashem, Vayomar, and he said, Vine Hashem Osa Rubos Bashamayim. He mocked him. He said, is Hashem going to make skylights in the heaven? Hayia Kadavar Hazeh, will such a thing happen? Vayomar, and Elisha had answered him, Hin Charoa Beinecho, you will see with your eyes, Umisham Lo Sokel, but you will not get to eat from it. You'll see it, but you will not get to eat from it. Vahilo Cain, that is exactly what happened to him. He saw it with his own eyes, but he was not able to enjoy it. Vayirmisuo soha am bashar vayamos, the nation trampled him in the gate, and he was killed.
Why repeat the whole thing again?
Good question.
Repeat the whole thing again with the story about Elisha.
Because they knew that it was since last week that we did the first part of the story. Yeah, it's a good question. Yes. Now, we have to address that, of course, why it was repeated. And there are several points that we have to understand here with this story, which, as I said, involves Gehazi and his sons, and involves saving the city of Shomron. Now, let's address the repetition, at least at face value. Maybe we'll get a little bit more in-depth later, but at least at face value, the repetition is drawing our attention to the mida kineged mida, the measure for measure that takes place over here, which is the main point in the story. As I mentioned to you, the Gemara in Maseches Sanhedrin, when the Gemara tells us that Hashem operates mida kineged mida, measure for measure, which is something which you find throughout the Chumash and throughout Navi, and the Gemara regularly points it out that Hashem operates measure for measure. When the Gemara asks the question, prove to me that Hashem operates measure for measure, show me where you see it, This is the story the Gemara leads off with. It has a few different proofs, but this is the lead-off story of measure for measure, midah kenegen midah. Because here you have exactly it's right in front of your face that Elisha made a prediction. The shalish mocked him. Elisha said, "You mock, then you won't get it." And it's exactly what happened. You'll see it, but you won't get it. And exactly that way it happened. The Gemara brings this as an example, for as the Gemara says that we know that a person who does not believe in Techias HaMesim, in the resurrection of the dead, will not merit to have that happen to that person. We have to believe in Techias HaMesim, and a person who does not believe it won't. The punishment is Mida Kenegin Mida, measure, they won't get it. And the Gemara brings this story as its primary example of that. So the repetition simply is to state it very clearly. Look at the progression over here. Don't miss the boat. Don't miss the main point of this story, which is that Hashem operates Mida Kenegin Mida, measure for measure. Yeah.
Okay, so the thing is, this is an influential person because he works for the king. So people look up to him, and the king looks up to him, and people are already starving. And he's just trying to give people some Yirah Shemayim, and he's mocking the whole thing.
Right. It was a terrible thing that he did, and he paid with his life. Yeah.
You've got this story, which I understand the measure for measure in that one, but you've got this other story where these people did something wrong to get Zaras, and yet they're the first ones that end their starving.
Good, good.
Right?
Okay, we're talk
and
about
they
it.
Get all this booty and stuff ahead of everyone else that they can hide twice what everyone else is going to get at least.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you're telling me measure for measure, you've got to explain measure for measure.
That's our next.
It's not over.
Yeah, that's our next.
They're highlighting the story as the example.
Yeah, well, it's a clear example. It's a clear example. But now we have to now go through the Arba Mitzvah, and that we have to discuss. So that's our next step over here. So the glaring issue over here is that the city of Shomron is starving to death, and they evidently deserve to be saved. We discussed last week what the king Yehoram did and the people did, and in order to deserve that they now be saved. So, and they are. And Elisha announces in advance, by tomorrow, everything will be fine. You'll see. So, and that's exactly what happens. But the way Hashem brings it about is through these four mitzvahim. And the obvious question is, why would this salvation be brought about through people who were evil, who did bad things? Gehazi lost his chelek in Olam Haba, lost his portion of the world to come. The same Mishnah that says that a person who doesn't believe in Tchias HaMesim doesn't get it, says that Gehazi is one of the people that we know of in Tanakh who loses his portion of the world to come. We have not discussed fully what he did, but he does lose it. And that's still a loose end, which we have to tie up at a certain point in the future when we discuss Elisha trying to get Gehazi to do tshuva. We have to discuss what he did wrong. But he's going to lose his chelek in Olam Haba. So why would a whole city of Jews be saved because of Gehazi and his sons? It doesn't seem to make sense. You would expect such a great thing would come through Big Tzadikim. The merit of some great tzaddik or some great tzaddikis would save this city. But instead, it's these four people that saved the city. Yeah.
Maybe to show that even if you are evil, you still got hope, or maybe for the future tshuva, if they're trying to, that they can still, either they still had some good in them, or they still also did, and, you know.
Okay,
It doesn't always just have to be through tzaddikim.
Okay, so can anybody tell me where you find that it's a rather famous case that Tzaras specifically, which is a bad thing, no matter how you slice it, Tzaras is a bad thing, that Tzaras has a positive result?
houses when they went there, and the house had saras, and they took down the bricks. There could be treasure behind the house.
Excellent. Okay, perfect. So the Chumash says that when we come to Eretz Yisrael, Hashem says, "V'nasati nega tzaras beveis Eretz Achuzaschem," I will place an affliction of tzaras on your homes. So it's a funny thing to say, I will place. I mean, it should say, if it happens, this is how you deal with it. What do you mean, I will place tzaras? So Chazal tells Rashi, says it over there, that because of the tzaras, Hashem, the rule with tzaras is on a home that you have to cut out the bricks. And when you cut out the bricks, you'll discover a cavity in the wall. And down there, you'll find treasure that was hidden by the Amorim, by the Canaanim who lived in Eretz Yisrael before we came. And they hid their treasure in the wall, and we'll find it with the tzaras. Now over there, one can ask the same question. Why would Hashem, if he wants to give us their treasure, why do it through tzaras? Tzaras is a bad thing. Why do it through tzaras? One can ask that question. Now, just as a just by word of clarification, in that particular instance, that where the tzaras bricks are taken out of the wall and treasure is found behind the wall, so it could be that the Kohen comes to the house, sees the tzaras, and rules that it is in fact tzaras, because remember the Kohen has to be the one to decide about that, and it does fit the parameters of tzaras, and therefore the Torah requires that this man cut the bricks out of the house. So he does, cuts the stones out of the house, and he finds treasure behind the stones. That is possible, but that's what it means. It is also possible that the Kohen comes to the house, looks at the tzaras, and says, this is not halachic tzaras. It's not. It doesn't look good, but it does not fit the rules of tzaras. The house is tahar. You need not do anything. That's what he tells the man of the house. The woman of the house comes home later and says to the man of the house, get those stones out of my living room. They look horrible. So he has to cut the stones out of the house. And when he does so, they discover treasure behind the stones. So it does come through an affliction, but it does not necessarily have to come through halachic tzaras. It may just come through something which has to be ruled on and turns out that it may be okay. But either way, the Chumash is telling us that they will discover treasure in that manner. So Hashem brings treasure through tzaras. What is the message of bringing treasure through tzaras? So there, the message seems to be that Hashem is telling the person who got tzaras on his house. We know that tzaras on a house could be for one of two main reasons. It could be that it's a progression. The Gemara says that Hashem first afflicts the house. If a person doesn't do tshuva, then his clothing gets tzaras. And if he still doesn't do tshuva, then his body gets tzaras. It's a progression, which is a chesed from Hashem, not to hit the person between the eyes right off the bat, but rather that it be incremental, and hopefully he'll do tshuva. That's one of the ways Hashem operates. But it can also be for specific sins that have to do with the house. As we know, one of the reasons for tzaras is stinginess. A person who is stingy gets there's tzaras on the house for being stingy. So that can also be. But the whatever it is, the tzaras is it's a wake-up call. It's a person has to realize they're not behaving properly. And a person needs to be mefashfesh b'maisav, which means to be introspective and figure out, what am I doing wrong? What needs improvement? Because tzaras is a message to improve. So therein lies the treasure, that Hashem sends the message to improve, and the person follows the rules of the Torah and cuts out the stones from the house and discovers treasure, which is a message from Hashem. I'm not punishing you because I don't like you. I'm not punishing you because I'm mean and I want to get you back for doing an Avera. I'm punishing you because I love you and I want you to do better so that you will earn a greater portion in Olam Haba. You will come closer to me. And I want you to know that. So even within the tzaras, I'm going to shower you with bracha. I'm going to give you a huge amount of treasure. Perhaps you're having a problem being stingy, and maybe that's why you got tzaras on the house. Look, here's treasure. Here's your opportunity to be generous. Take the treasure and do something good with the treasure. Correct what you did wrong. Take the treasure and go help out some people with the treasure. Do something that'll counteract your natural sense of stinginess. Something like that. That's what the treasure is meant to do for people. It doesn't mean every single time there was tzaras, there was treasure. But it was a possible consequence, and it did happen. And it did happen. So here you have Gehazi. And Gehazi, as we know, received the tzaras of Naaman. Without going through that whole story again, we went through it a couple of weeks ago, but we learned then that Naaman had tzaras because Naaman was given a miraculous, really miraculous event that took place through him in killing Ahav, and he became arrogant because of it and wasn't willing to see that it was from Hashem. But slowly, Naaman improved. He ended up becoming a Ger Toshav, as we learned a few weeks ago. Gehazi, who is in the house of Elisha, and knows better than anyone the greatness of Elisha, knows better than anyone all the miracles that Elisha performs, and the information that Elisha is aware of in advance of it happening and without having been told. And Gehazi is unfazed by the greatness of Elisha, where he's still willing to go against his master. Elisha told Naaman, "I don't want your gifts. I don't want your money." Naaman started heading back to Aram. Gehazi ran after him and said, "My master changed his mind." Which, you know, and then Gehazi over there went and hid the treasure, as he does over here as well, and thinks he can pull one over Elisha, where he can trick Elisha. Elisha, who seems to know things that are going on miles away and no one tells him, and he just knows it. And Gehazi thinks he can get away without telling Elisha. And as soon as Elisha sees him, he says to him, what'd you do with the, where were you? What's with the booty that you took? And therefore, he gets the tzaras of Naaman, specifically the tzaras of Naaman, because Gehazi represents what Naaman had represented, which is a person who is not allowing the obvious messages that are literally hitting him in the face, not letting them penetrate, and just say, "I don't care. I'm going to go. I want my money. I want the treasure. I don't want to be affected by all these things that I see." So here, Naaman and his sons are outside the city, and here Hashem gives Gehazi and his sons are outside the city. And Gehazi and his sons are the ones that have the opportunity to literally turn it around. To, instead of being arrogant, instead of being greedy, which is really what Gehazi was, he was very greedy. Here, they have the opportunity to literally save a city. They can see that the people of Aram are gone, and perhaps you can eat something quickly so that you have the strength, and then run to the city to save everybody's lives. You can be the hero. You can literally be the hero. You can be held up as the people who saved the city of Shomron. That's what they could have done. But instead, all they can think about is themselves. Hashem was giving them an opportunity to turn things around, to make things better, to correct what they had done wrong. And instead, all they can think about is their own selves. My own stomach, my own bank account, and then we have to tell the city of Shomron because of my own neck. But it's not because of helping anybody. It's not because I'm concerned for the well-being of anybody else. And Gehazi, rather than using the opportunity to correct what he had done wrong, because now he's facing yet another incredible miracle with the people gone. That itself is a huge miracle. But instead of allowing that to affect him, he continues on in this negative way. Now that's from the perspective of Gehazi. What about from the perspective of Shomron itself? The people of Shomron, the king of Shomron, who were not tzaddikim, yet they deserve to be saved, but they're saved through four people who have tzaras. There's an incident in Shoftim, in the book of Shoftim, with Shimshon, the great Shimshon, HaGibor, and Shimshon there saves the Jews repeatedly. And at one point, after he fights off and beats a whole army worth of Plishtim to protect his brothers, to protect the Jewish people, he then finds himself incredibly thirsty. Thirsty to the point that he will die of dehydration. Because after the battle, he had not drunk anything during the battle, and it weakened him. And now he's by himself. Shimshon was a lone fighter. That was the whole Mitzvah Hashem. One day we'll learn Shoftim. We'll talk about Shimshon. Shimshon, the whole point of how he saved the Jewish people was that he was a loner. That was what Hashem wanted. And that's the role that he played very, very well. And as he did that, there was no support for him. So there he is, having defeated this huge army of Plishtim. He's exhausted, he's dehydrated, he collapses, and there's no one to bring him any water. So Hashem, he davens to Hashem, and Hashem does a nes for him, and he picks up a jawbone of a donkey, and the jawbone of the donkey has water pouring from it, and he's able to drink from the jawbone of the donkey lots of water, and it revives him, and he's able to go on. But our sages tell us, Chazal say, that Shimshon was saved with a tamei animal. He was forced to drink from the jawbone of a donkey. A donkey is not a kosher animal. And he was forced to drink from the jawbone of a donkey animal. It's not kosher. You're allowed to drink water from the jawbone of a donkey. But it's not a nice thing. It doesn't show a great the gift that Hashem had given him was not packaged nicely. As you know, when you give a gift, you can give a gift here it is, or you can package it, you can put a ribbon on it, you can make it really nice, and it makes a big difference. When you package it, it makes a very big difference. The gift to Shimshon was not packaged nicely, and it was sending a message to Shimshon about something he had done wrong. And it was a message to him that he needed to improve. Mitzvah Hashem, when we learn about Shimshon one day, we'll go through that story and have a chance to discuss what it was that he did wrong and how this was a message, etc. But that's the precedent for this type of story. The people of Shomron were being saved. Elisha predicted they would be saved. And they were saved. And it's a wonderful, unbelievable thing. It was miraculous. And Hashem gave them all the food they needed. It was given to them. And they didn't have to work for it. They didn't have to fight for it. Here it is. But it's not packaged nicely. The package is four Mitzorayim are the ones who come and announce the find. It's not packaged nicely. Packaging it nicely would have been that Elisha would have been told to tell Yehoram ben Achav, so says Hashem, leave the gates of the city, go to the camp of Aram, you will find they are gone, and all the food there is ready for you to take. But Elisha was not told to tell that to the king of Aram. Elisha was only told to tell him, by tomorrow, the price of food will drop precipitously. That's all he was told to say. And therefore, the way it happens is through these four people left Taras, which is not a pretty packaging. Which is a message to the people of Shomron, yes, you're being saved, but don't think that I think, says Hashem, that you've really improved. You have a lot of work to do. I'm willing to save you. You deserve to be saved, but you got a lot of work ahead of you, and you got to work on it, and you can't just say, well, you know, back to business as usual. Yeah.
They figure it out?
No. At least the king does not, as we'll see later on. Yeah.
It bothers me that the four Mitzrayim, they don't thank Hashem, they don't realize it. Okay, fine, they had an opportunity, they didn't. But all these people plus the king, it doesn't say, and then they put an altar and they thank Hashem.
Yeah.
Or they sang the song of gratitude to Hashem.
Yeah, yeah. Now they may.
Don't bother about
that. They may have. They may have, and it's not told to us because it's insignificant. Because they were idolaters, and this did not turn them around. At the end of the day, the 10 tribes led by Shomron is not going to turn around. But even before that point, the next thing that's going to happen to the northern kingdom is another rebellion and a new dynasty. Assuming the throne. The dynasty of Ahav is about to end, Yehoram is going to be killed, and the new dynasty of Yehu ben Nimshi is going to assume the throne of the northern kingdom.
So how many years has this king been in office?
This king is a total of 12 years. I don't think we're up to the 12 years yet, but soon it'll be 12 years. But the Ahav before him, before also Ahaziah before him, and Omri before him. So there were four kings from Ahav's family, and then they're going to get killed out, and we'll have the new dynasty take the throne. So we'll discuss that. That's coming up shortly. But as much as we've seen, Yehoram is better than Ahav. The Navi himself says so, that Yehoram is not as bad as Ahav, but he is still bad. He's still bad. And even though he does do a little bit of a tshuva here, it's not enough. And ultimately, he will be destroyed along with his family.
It's Yoram and
Yehoram. Yehoram and Yoram are the same person.
Then why do they write like on the next chapter Yoram ben Achav and here it's Yoram ben Yehoshaphat?
Yeah, there are two Yehoram / Yorams.
Okay.
Yeah, there are two of them. We mentioned it last week already, and we'll discuss it again in the future because we're going to discuss the family tree again. But they're related to each other. They have the same name. It's very confusing.
But one's with a hay and one is without.
No. Sometimes each one is spelled with or without the hay.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
So just, but like
they have the same name.
Yonatan and Yonatan, is it also the same?
Depends on, sometimes yes, it depends on the case.
But it's the same Yonatan?
Yeah, usually. I don't think, Yonatan is always spelled with a hay, I believe.
In
Shmuel, I think it's always spelled Yonatan. Pretty sure. But there are a lot of names where the hay is either added or subtracted depending on the case. Now this siege of Shomron, which resulted in such a terrible, terrible famine within Shomron, is not in a vacuum. You see, in order, any city that's under siege is going to have deprivation, and there's going to be problems of not having enough food, etc. But there's a difference between a city that is laid, that is put under siege, when the city is well provided for and well stocked, and then a siege begins. So it takes much longer for the city to succumb. You don't have the widespread starvation. It's hard for people, but it's not fatal. A city that begins with having very little supplies, very few supplies, and very very little in the warehouses, you put that city under siege, then it's really, really terrible. With Tisha B'Av coming up, as you probably know, the second Beis HaMikdash, the Romans laid siege to the city. There were provisions within the city, the Gemara says, to last for 21 years. They could have outlasted a Roman siege. For 21 years, there was enough to feed everybody and take care of everybody for that amount of time. But the Biryuni, the faction of Jews in Yerushalayim who wanted to pick a fight with the Romans, they were trying to force a fight. They did not want the Jewish people to simply hold themselves up in Yerushalayim and wait out the siege. They wanted to fight, and therefore they burned the storehouses of food, which left the Jews in terrible stress. What ensued was absolutely horrific starvation in the city because there was nothing left to eat. So the city of Shomron over here, the fact that the siege made them have absolutely nothing to eat indicates that there was really a problem to begin with, that food was scarce even before the siege. That's going to lead to the next story, which we're not going to do now, but Mirtz Hashem will do when we return, that the next story, the Navi is going to introduce a seven-year famine that takes place at this time. This story we just read happens during the seven-year famine, which is why there's so little food to begin with in Shomron, and the siege just destroys the city. That just breaks the city, because there is a terrible famine in the land to begin with. The if you are able to read it, if you look in Eicha, you can look at this on Tisha B'Av, the Targum on Eicha, the Aramaic translation of Eicha, begins the very beginning. No, I take that back. It is not in the beginning of Eicha. I take that back. Okay, I'll leave that out. There is a discussion about many famines. It's actually the beginning of Rus, where there's a famine over there. And then the famine over here is mentioned in the Targum over there as well. But there is a mention of the famine. Okay, we're going to leave that out because I can't remember where to direct you to. But at any rate, this is one of the major famines that is listed in Chazal, that is listed as one of the 10 major famines in the history of the world. This one here is the 9th of the 10 famines. The 10th one we are either experiencing right now or we will experience, and that is not a famine for food or for water, but rather it is Kiyam Lishmos Devarei Hashem. It is a famine in hearing the word of Hashem, which might mean not having Nevuah, not having prophecy, which is where we are right now. So we'll discuss this Mirtz Hashem next time.
Is that just Midah Keneged Midah, that you know, the famine, like the Tzarat and whatever that is brought upon them? Is that also like comes in Shlavim and it's a warning or whatever, or that has nothing?
Well, the famine could very well be. Yeah, but we're not told why this famine happens, although next time we will discuss that, Mirtz Hashem, but we're not told about it. Okay, so this is where we're going to pick up when we start again, Mirtz Hashem. Now, but just before we break, I do want to mention one thing, which is that, we'll put this on the recording, we had an astute listener, Dr. Yaakov Berendt, was listening to these classes and came over to me and told me that before Shavuos, the last class before Shavuos, we were discussing when Eliyahu went up to Shamayim, and then we discussed that Elisha met up with the 42 young men that cursed him, and the bears came and they ate the young men, that whole story back there. And we ended off that class with several important questions about the 42 young men and about Eliyahu going up to Shamayim, etc. And we said we would address that in the next class. The next class wasn't for 2 weeks because Shavuos interrupted our class. And the next class, we began with the next chapter and did not answer any of those questions. So he asked me, did he miss something? And I went back and I listened and I realized he did not miss something. I forgot to tie up those loose ends. So I'm telling you that we will never get back to that. There is an opportunity later on in Malachim to revisit that story. It's going to tie in anyway. We're going to have to go back to that story to tie in certain things. And when we do that, then Blinetter, we will cover those loose ends that we left at that time. And we will conclude with a Tzeisel Mashalim for Dr. Fari.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.